I deal with this with people that have nine figures, that have eight figures. Scarcity mindset is very hard to unlearn. A lot of times it's from formative memories during our childhood.
How do you find the right balance?
The only two things investments can do are they can make money for you over time or they can make money for you on time.
You're referring to the concept of die with zero, right?
You're living your life in this weird mindset where like the worst versions of everything will all happen at once. And therefore, I have to not spend the money now.
What are your thoughts on cryptocurrencies?
It should have the payoff dynamics of what an angel investment could look like. But the difference is...
Someone who's making, say, the average income, like $65,000, how can they build up enough wealth that they actually have freedom to either do nothing if that's what they want or do work that's more meaningful?
If you're not saving a portion of your take-home pay in some mechanism to have it grow again to allow you to live today's life in tomorrow's dollars, you don't really have that much of a chance.
What are your thoughts on the FIRE movement?
All you can do is implore people to do the math, try to be patient, live for today and for tomorrow. But if you just live for today, tomorrow's gonna be stressful.
What are your thoughts on Warren Buffett saying 95% of people should stick with the index funds?
I have a funny statistic. At a major brokerage firm, there's two types of client accounts that are the best performers. What do you think the profile is?
In today's episode, we're talking to Adam Katz, a renowned wealth advisor for nine-figure entrepreneurs.
We'll delve into the fundamental principles of wealth accumulation that anyone can use, regardless of their financial status.
Stick till the end to learn how to retire early with only $300,000 in savings.
I recently saw a YouTube video, and it was like going viral. Someone in their 40s, they posted a video that they retired on $300,000 and they like moved to like Philippines.
Right.
And so what comes to your mind when you hear stories like that on retiring on a really low amount, like 300K?
I feel like it's very one-off-y and not attainable for most people, but it's interesting to read about. I think that the amount of choices you need to make, depending on where you grow up and where you think about value and fun and utility, you know, that number won't get you very far if it needs to generate income for you. So what I always remind people of, the only competition for you living your life today is what you want someone maybe to get when you die. So using the $300,000 example, it's actually interesting because if you live somewhere where it costs $10,000 a year to live, which I'm sure there's places on the planet you can actually earn nothing on it and just spend it down. 30 years, right? You could just spend down the money. I think that most people that I would imagine that are listening to this are going to say, well, I don't want to just spend all my money. I want to earn something on my money. So right now, you know, you can lend a dollar to the government, call it a treasury bill, or you can even put it in a money market and a cash type of yield, and you get 5%. So if you think about it, if you had $300,000 and you lent it all to the government, they're going to give you $15,000 a year right now of interest. So it's about $1,200 a month to live on. So some people would look at it like that because they don't want to touch their principal. Some people are willing to touch some of their principal, and you can easily model how long that would last you. And then some people, as I said, might just spend down all of that principal. So I think you can model it. I think that that type of a number, you know, really would need to be in certain pockets of the world where the purchasing power allows you to live the lifestyle you want. I think the other side of it is most people have ways to earn money along the way, right? Everyone gets out, most people can get out of bed, and they're going to do something that will supplement the burn. So even if you move to the Philippines and you had $300,000 to start and you were earning some kind of yield like I described, you might have a job that you're doing that, you know, is super fulfilling, isn't very stressful, and it helps you pay for a lot of your day-to-day living, maybe nothing extravagant, where then it's quite easy to live that way. But again, without understanding the cost of living in a lot of these places, it's so hard. And also without understanding the way someone has an emotion of what's left when they die, if anything, and if they care. I think to me, that's always the thing that I start with at any wealth level is, again, the only competition for you living your lifestyle is some terminal value you believe someone deserves when you die. And if you don't have that competition, then it could change radically how much you need at any given point in life to not have to get up every day and have a job. Most people work, but they don't necessarily have a job.
I see what you're saying. So essentially, you're referring to the concept of die with zero, right? There's a book with the same name, right?
Yeah.
So assuming that the person making $300,000 do not want to leave.
Oh, making $300,000.
Oh, sorry. No,
sorry. Now we're having a different discussion. Okay. All right. I thought I misheard you and I went on a tangent.
Yeah. So they have $300,000. They move to the Philippines. They have really low expenses and they want to die with zero. So your general advice would be to use that $300,000, like maybe put it in treasury bills or S&P 500 and have that investment grow while getting like a menial job or something that's fulfilling, right?
Yeah, I mean, you could do, I think, yes and. So the and is you can do a lot. It can do a lot of math around this. There's a lot of models. I'm in the midst of writing a book, and I was writing a chapter about like 1998, 2000 vintage. And, you know, the horsepower that I had with my team in like a centralized part of the firm I was at is probably what you can do on your iPhone now. Meaning like you could probably model what you would need to earn in sort of a more day-to-day job and how long it should last you. And then in terms of what to do with the money, rather than calling it a thing, meaning like what kind of investment, it's really what do you want the investment to do? So I try to remind people the only two things investments can do are they can make money for you over time or they can make money for you on time. And so when you talk about like buying a treasury bill, essentially you're not expecting anything interesting other than the interest. So it will pay you on time. Like a bond. If you lend your money to a municipality that you live in, they're going to pay you on time. And as long as you believe they're going to be creditworthy and be there at the end of the maturity, you'll get your money back. Super boring, very visible, very predictable. You flip that with the S&P 500, and there you have the introduction of volatility, and you have the introduction of getting paid over time, meaning the main way you're going to make money outside of some of the dividends is going to be that the S&P, the combination of these 500 stocks, goes up. The problem is that the path isn't like this. It's like this. And of course, when you zoom out, these moves look like this. But if you zoom back in and it's like this, and you're a forced seller here because you needed the money for something, now the volatility became risk because it was loss of principal. So you always try to caution people that really understand the purpose of your money, the personality of your money. If you have some type of a retirement account and you're in your 20s or 30s or 40s, that's going to be the money of last resort to go to dinner or go on vacation. So there you can probably handle this because it's unlikely you'd be forced to sell to do those activities. And if you did, that would be the money of last resort and you would deal with it at the time. But that location of money empowers and allows you to compartmentalize and think about it a little bit differently. But if it's non-retirement money, which you can touch and feel and get access to and go to dinner and go on vacation, you just want to be mindful of, you know, when you need it. And in the $300,000 example, you might say, hey, you know what? For $200,000, I want to get paid on time. I want some type of supplemental income. But $100,000 of it, I think I can put in something more growth oriented so that in 10, 20 years, it's worth more. Whereas the other stuff, I'm not going to eat into the principal, but I'm going to eat all the interest. I'm going to spend all the interest. It's going to help me supplement my lifestyle. So my guess is that it can be a combination. But I would say that, you know, thinking about a treasury bill or a bond where you get paid on time is really different than investing in a collection of stocks that don't pay you very much on time. You're just hoping they go up in price over time. You just can't predict when that will be and if it aligns with when you'll need it. So you need to be mindful that you won't be a forced seller at a bad time. Does that make sense?
Right. No, it does. So that's a similar strategy that Kay uses, right? So he has all his money invested in S&P 500. And when he's in need of some cash, instead of like selling stocks, he will just take it out on margin, right?
Yeah, his you know, he and I are good friends. His strategy is a little extreme, and it's on a relatively large denominator, especially as we talk about the broader audience here. I would say for a person that is in the situation you described, I think that would probably give most people agita. I would probably invest some of it in something growth oriented, like, you know, the broad US markets, like the S&P 500. But I would think that, you know, depending on how much money you're making and how much you're spending, you probably want to be mindful to not have all of it that way and then have to, you know, use leverage and borrow against it. Almost like the best way to think about it, it's like using your investments as like a house and then taking out a home equity line. That's what margin is. So you just want to be mindful of that. It's not probably the strategy I would recommend for most people, or really any people. That doesn't mean it can't work. And again, I love Kay like a brother. He knows it. But what he does is pretty extreme.
So
again,
he kind
for
of
someone
overrode
that you're describing.
Your, so he kind of overrode your again. Advice, override it?
Well, you know, we're partners. You know, there's not exactly a full pecking order. It's also, listen, the beauty of having an advisor is that they advise you. It doesn't mean you always have to listen to everything. I also, with him, you know, if you keep the amount of leverage you have against the portfolio very low, then you have a good chance of never having an issue. The biggest issue with margin is if you have one of these portfolios that does this, at some point, if you have too much leverage and the portfolio is here, the firm that provided that loan will sell out of all of your stocks or the portfolio at that point. And now you've crystallized the loss. All the money's now gone. You can't. What you want to do is make sure that you don't have too big of a loan so that if it's going like this, it never triggers what's called a margin call, which, you know, there's a big movie that has the same name.
Right.
So again, I am not advocating that people subscribe to that strategy. Again, Kay was a professional investor. He's worked at a big hedge fund and investment firm and has his chartered financial analyst, charter holder. He's a professional investor. It's probably not at all what I would recommend for most people. I think taking a barbell approach I described for someone that could say, hey, I have a certain amount of money that will pay me on time. It's sort of boring, but it's a supplemental income. It's got predictability and visibility. I have optionality if I want that money to do a nice vacation or buy a special gift for someone. I know that it's going to be worth what I put in. That's great. If I have a certain amount of money that either through a structural advantage like a retirement account can grow and I'm not going to use it because just there's penalties to get access to it like a retirement account, then I can probably compartmentalize that can grow. That can be my growth engine. So without the actual delineation of account types, retirement, non-retirement, I still think it's healthy to potentially siphon off a portion of the money that you can handle that type of volatility. And sometimes you can even handle less liquidity, as there's some investments that might offer you a different return stream in exchange for not having liquidity for years.
Right. So in that example where we're putting $100,000 in S&P 500, how do I reconcile the die with zero philosophy? Because in my head, I want that $100,000 to become a million in like 30 years, right?
Right.
So how do I balance those two opposing philosophies?
Yeah, your expectation is that you may eventually need to eat into the capital base of the $200,000, again, using this $300,000 consistent example. So in your example, you had $200,000 sort of boring, just generating some interest. Lifestyle might start to creep. Your $100,000 is maybe now worth $150,000 that was in the S&P 500. And you have to do something to perhaps keep your lifestyle. And so you need to maybe sell something. So I think part of why you need to invest in something like the S&P is that if you're worried that things will cost more in the future than they do today, meaning how do I live today's life in tomorrow's dollars, affectionately referred to as inflation, you might want part of your capital base to be growing so that in 10, 15 years, it'll be there for you to convert it back into an income generator. You may have to realize some taxes at that point. But the reality is, I don't know if everyone is looking to die with zero. I think that if that's your philosophy, there's a lot of math you can do and figure out really what kind of return do you need and what's the least stressful way to get there and how do you couple it with earned income along the way at different ages. So again, I don't know if I subscribe to that philosophy. I tell everyone to me, die with zero should be a result of, not a goal itself. At least that's my take on it.
Wait, can you explain that? Result of?
Yeah, it's a result. If you end up dying with zero and you live this amazing lifestyle and that's what it resulted in, great. If you lived your amazing lifestyle and you have some money left over, I think that's fine. Meaning if you're not sacrificing for and you still have money left, I don't know what else you would do other than ramp up spending that you didn't think you needed to. Ramp up family or charitable support while you're alive. Those are all reasons. But I'm saying that if you're not sacrificing for some terminal value, so meaning you're not going on a vacation, you're not having a great meal with a friend, and you're doing all of those things, and you still just have money left over, I don't think that that's the spirit of die with zero. I think the spirit of die with zero is die with zero so that you aren't sacrificing memory making and living during great years. But I don't think that the goal should be to die with zero. At least that's my perspective. I think that if that's the result, great. But if there's money left over for people you love and things that you love, I think that's okay. Again, as long as you didn't sacrifice it.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on the FIRE movement? Have you heard of it?
Of course. Okay. You know, it's interesting as these ideas come about and they how do you make a verb out of acronyms? But, you get these acronyms. I have a lot of phrases, but I don't have a lot of acronyms. And, when I think about FIRE, it seems to have gone through its own version of like it was really hot and now it's not. Again, I may just be a little out of touch. I feel like conceptually it's interesting, and I think it's quite analogous to the person you were describing with 300,000, but then they port themselves to an environment where that denominator solves the math equation. So I think, I feel like when I was reading a lot about it, when again, it seemed much more front and center in the press, it was, hey, I by 32 have $1 million and I'm done. And it's because right now on $1 million, I can get 5%, and that's about $50,000 a year, which is about $4,000 a month, which is a lot of money. And I'm going to go now I'm going to go live somewhere, not where I likely earned it. Now we're in a much more flexible, mobile economy. But, you might actually have to move somewhere in this country or maybe somewhere else on the planet even, where that $1 million supports the lifestyle you want, at least for the near term. And the near term could be a decade or two. I think it's interesting. I think, as a person a little further along in life than sort of that movement, I'm getting, as I tell people now, if you are 32 or younger, you're closer in age to my son than me, which makes me feel weird. but I feel like as a person who's approaching, half a century and maybe in a position in a different way to have that FIRE thing, I don't know, what else am I going to do? I really love spending my day the way I do, and maybe not everyone does, so that's fair. But I think a lot of times people end up working. Again, I think there's a conflation with working and having a job. Having a job is a thing that you feel obligated that you have to get up for. You have a very set, personal time off. But a lot of people will work and they will still earn. So that $1 million in my FIRE example, that's not the sole source of how they're going to live going forward. So I don't think people really just pack it up and just do nothing for the next 30, 40, 50, 60 years on the planet. I think what happens is people can have a capital base, but I've also watched people that think they're sort of done. And, a lot of times people spend more than they thought they were going to. A lot of parts of life happen that you cannot predict. But I like that people are thinking non-linearly. That's probably the thing that I like the most. I feel like that, a generation or two ago, you come out of college, you work at the same place for 50 years, 30 years, 40 years. You have a defined benefit pension, which are mostly things of the past. And that's it. You just what you do. Whereas very few people anymore. I worked at one company for 20 years, which makes me an anomaly. So I do like that people are challenging that there's a lot of other ways to spend your life. I think that there's a lot of speed bumps that have entered into society. I think that fire is good because it makes people think like, oh, maybe that's a different way. That doesn't mean it is, but even the exercise of wondering if it is, even the exercise of that speed bump is awesome. I tell people that COVID, while it had so many horrific elements of death and sickness, what it did do is it slowed us all down. And it said, why do we all spend 12 hours, 10 hours, 8 hours a week commuting? Is it better? People saying things like, I spend more time with my colleagues than my friends and family, as that was a badge of honor. Is that better? I think a lot of those things are weird. And I do think COVID created this societal speed bump where people are like, wait, I can live in a different place. I'm a visceral human being that deals with nature in absolutes. You don't have a relative amount of, you know, nature. You're absolute. You're either outside and you're in the wilderness and you're near a stream and an ocean and you're hearing and feeling sand, or you're just in the city on a 8x10 terrace and you have a relative amount of space. So I feel like, you know, fire is good because it forces people to wonder if they're doing it the right way or if there's a way that's better and more aligned with them. And I feel like, again, I do believe that COVID changed the way people think about the way they bookend their day. And from a commuting perspective and from a location perspective, you can spend a lot more of your time on this planet with the people you chose and the people you love. I think it's awesome. So again, a little bit of a different answer to what I think of fire. But again, I think that fire is a great mechanism for people to question linearity and just inertia.
I think, you know, what a lot of people who are probably watching are really wondering is someone who's making, say, the average or median income, what is that now, like 65,000?
Yeah, something like that.
How can they build up enough wealth that they actually have freedom to either do nothing if that's what they want or do work that's more meaningful for them? So freedom, at least from the job.
Yeah, I mean, I think you'll hear a couple of things that I think are good advice. One is really understand the power of compounding. You know, if you're not saving a portion of your take-home pay in some mechanism to have it grow again to allow you to live today's life in tomorrow's dollars, you don't really have that much of a chance. You know, my dad was a guidance counselor in the Bronx for 31 years. He made $48,000 a year. But when he retired, maybe he made 55 at the end. But when he retired at 55, he got $48,000 for the next 28 years until he died. People these days, unless you're doing something like being a teacher, you know, you're a firefighter, you're a police officer, you don't have a defined benefit plan. You have a defined contribution, which means you're saving in something like a 401k, and it's up to you to make sure you have that money in the future. And I think that's daunting, but I do think that people underestimate how much they're going to need. And I think they also underestimate cumulative effect of these small increments. So, you know, as people look at the math, I think I would always say start early. And even if it's $5 a week, you know, it's easy. And everyone always uses like the lame throwaway, like instead of a latte, do this. That's fair. It's fair. And it's true. I get frustrated when people talk about, well, this costs as much as this. And I'm always like, well, but are you not doing the other thing? Because everything costs as much as something. But I do think that if you did $5 a week, you know, you'd be surprised what that leads to. Because you'd be at the end of the year, there's, you know, $5 a week, 50 weeks, just for simplicity, it's $250. And that one $250, let's say you did that in your early 20s. And let's say you live till, I don't know, let's say 90 years old. So you have 70 years. We'll use the law of 70. We'll do 10% return just because the math's going to be easier. We'll do 7% return, excuse me. So if you make 7% a year and, you know, we live for 70 years, it's the way it works is if you multiply 7% times 10 years, you get about 70. The law of 72 is when you multiply things by each other, it doubles. Like, for instance, if you got 6%, it would take 12 years. 6 times 12 equals, obviously, 72. So in this case, if you had $250 and you're in your 20s and you're going to live 70 years, so that $250 of just that 1 year, it's going to double 7 times. Now, if I ask most people, like if I ask you guys, like, what do you think that equates to? Just throw out a number. 250 goes to what? I'm asking you guys.
10,000?
Yeah, you should be able to do this. You're in finance.
You guys are savvy, though. All right, well, let's do the math. So 250 becomes 500, 1,000, 2,000, 4,000, 8,000, 16,000. So what I tell people is, imagine you did that for the first 10 years of your, 20s into early 30s. You know, that's going to be, 160,000, 130,000. And that's just then. So I think that people underestimate that compounding because they can't see ahead. I have this fun expression, which is time machines exist, meaning like you can use a time machine for your brain. It's just very hard for your heart to feel excited about how you're going to feel at 90. So I think that part of it is you've got to compound, you got to do it early, and you've got to have some element of what people like to call delayed gratification. The reality is most people can't think that way. So I think more of where you're going to solve for this is the side hustle, which has really become popular. I think that for the same reasons, things like COVID changed the way you can work. A lot of people are finding ways to make additional money each year in a way that's totally on their schedule from their bedroom. And even there, it's the same kind of thing. Like maybe you could make an extra $5,000 a year and it feels like nothing, but then play my game again. Imagine you had an extra $3,000 a year and you just start doing the math and you're like, oh wait, if I invested an extra $3,000, way back when, 3,000 became 6,000, it became 12,000, 24,000, 48,000, 96,000, and 100, and what do we got at the end there? 192? I'm embarrassed. I'm so good at math. So that's $192,000 by making only an extra $5,000 a year before tax. I did 3 after tax. So like stuff like that, I don't think people can get their heads around compounding. So I think that it's understanding that, the math works. It's just like, I give the example of like weight loss, which this is going to have, it's analogous, it's not perfect. But most people, if I was like, hey, like, would you be psyched to lose 15 pounds this year? For most people, like, that would sound amazing. But like on every day, you can get on the scale and you're going to see like some fluctuation. Some of it's going to be correlated to the diet you had that day or what you ate. Some of it's going to be correlated to the general exercise you did, but it's not going to be linear. You're not going to lose like a 0.01 pound every single day on time. And at the end of the year, poof, you've got 15 pounds. But I do believe that if most people closed their eyes and woke up in a year and they lost 15 pounds, that'd be significant. I think people lose patience because they can't see the result fast enough. So, all you can do is implore people to do the math, try to be patient, live for today and for tomorrow. But if you just live for today, tomorrow's going to be stressful. And obviously, when I say tomorrow, I mean your 50s, 60s, 70s as you get into those years. The other thing I think people do with their modeling, guys, is that they forget that sadly, like when you get into your mid-70s, and if you keep living another 10, 20 years, it's going to be really different. What will be expensive is healthcare, and you've got to solve for that. But like you're not going to get to do all the cool stuff you're doing. So spending changes dramatically then too. And again, I think most people, if they were sitting there in their 70s and 80s, and maybe they weren't living the way they wanted, but they feel like they lived really the way they wanted, they made the memories they wanted, they supported people they wanted, they supported things that they wanted in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, most people I don't think are going to be regretting that. So that's the other thing that I don't think there's enough clarity for most people of how they would feel at that point. But I think for the most part, even if you're very wealthy and you're in your 70s and 80s, the money doesn't matter. You're not enjoying it in the way you're thinking. You probably can't enjoy food the same way anymore. You can't travel the same way anymore. You can't physically do things the way. I'm not trying to be depressing. It's just reality. So I think that people overvalue what they should have towards the end and undervalue those sort of golden years because there's just that scarcity mindset. But again, to me, it's about compounding, about the combination of and or saving a little bit every week and or earning a little bit extra every year through some type of a hustle, but doing it in a way that it probably aligns with stuff you like and it's on your time schedule.
I think this gets at the heart of what you're trying to convey is that most people have a hard time finding the right balance and that a lot of people spend too much now and don't save enough, but there are also a lot of people who save too much may not be the right way to express it, but they don't spend enough on the things that matter now or that they won't be able to do later. So how do you find the right balance?
If I knew, I would tell you guys. I think, and again, this transcends all wealth levels. I deal with this with people that have nine figures, that have eight figures. Scarcity mindset is very hard to unlearn. A lot of times it's from formative memories during our childhood of what was the relationship to money in the house. Things happen where you saw a parent lose a job and there were tough months or tough years. So I think what happens also is I try to help people look at the normal distribution curve of outcomes. So as you think about like one standard deviation, I think is like 68% of the time, then you go further out, it's 95 and maybe 99 at the end. And I think what happens is a lot of times people overweight that third standard deviation. They're like, that thing could happen. I'm like, well, it possibly can happen, but it's not probably going to happen. And so you're living your life in this weird mindset where like the worst versions of everything will all happen at once. So you have like these three or four things that could happen and you're like, all of them are going to happen. And therefore I have to not spend the money now. And I think, you know, on the flip side, you've got probably people who think it's as likely as they'll just figure it out, even though the math doesn't work and they just spend. So, you know, in my mind, it's really how can you not overvalue or overestimate the remote possibility of something versus the higher likelihood probability of outcomes? I think that helps a lot of people if they really try to step back. But I think it's hard for people to, again, there's these tetherings, there's these learnings from early stages of life that I don't know how to decouple.
I think another element of this is a lot of people probably get in the trap of spending money on impulse purchases. So, you know, they spend their discretionary income on things that are not actually generating memories or creating meaning in their life. And then they don't have the money for those things that really would be important. So how do you be a little more thoughtful about what you're splurging on, I guess you could say?
So I have an idea that I came up with recently, unrelated, but it's probably very similar. So at some point in the last year, I moved the icon on my phone for X, Twitter, somewhere else. I literally don't use Twitter anymore because of the way my thumbs are used to gliding across my phone. It's just not in the same rhythm anymore. And it would be annoying to use. So I just sort of stopped using it probably like 6-9 months ago. And I used to look at Twitter, I don't know, 10-20 times a day. So when you ask me the question, I think the problem with a lot of impulse shopping right now is that you have a remote control for pretty much anything in life in your hand. And obviously marketers are smart and technologists are smart and they make it so easy to buy anything. So I think that part of what I would suggest is if impulse buying gets done on your phone, make your apps to buy those things annoying to get to. And I do believe that, you know, the dopamine hit I would get from my Twitter feed isn't to be understated. I think the dopamine hit of buying stuff is big. But I think if you create some of your own speed bumps to get to it, I actually think that there's something to that. But I think that, again, I think the accessibility to stuff, the ease of pressing the button on your phone, having some type of facial recognition to have your Apple Pay pay something, it's made it really easy. And I think what you can do is do your best to put some of your own speed bumps in place that make it harder and more annoying. Like, we have a bar in our house downstairs, and I've got older kids, so it's locked. And our keys are up, you know, hidden somewhere. I was about to say where they are, but my kids might watch this. And they're 18 and 14 and 18, most of the planet that's fine to drink. But anyway, moving on. The unintended consequence, though, is Dana and I, who obviously are legal age, it's annoying to go upstairs to get the keys. I mean, I'm not that annoying. I consider myself pretty in shape, but like, it's a speed bump. And I bet we drink half of what we used to. So I think that it's, how do you create speed bumps that make something that's so easy a little more annoying? And then you figure out how important it really was to you if you're willing to drive over the speed bump every single time you got to get to the other side. So I don't know. I never really thought about the question the way you asked it, but I don't know. That's a way my brain decided to answer it.
I wanted to go back to that 300K example one more time. So we discussed that $200,000 invested in something safe, bonds, T-bills.
I won't use the word safe. I would say it's something that pays you on time. Because that's the, people can, and I'm not saying that they're not the same thing, but I'm just saying something that you know actually throws money into your account every month or every quarter. And that's the return. So it pays you on time versus, again, as we get to the S&P, I have no idea when it's going to make money for me. It's got a little dividend, but other than that, I don't know if it's going to be up this year. It's going to be down this year. And God forbid I need the money this year and it's down and I got to sell it. That stinks. So I messed up my time period. Sorry, I'm not sure where you were going with it, but I just wanted to, highlight that.
So what I'm going with it is like, so the 100K piece that's invested in S&P 500,
yeah.
Would you advise using dollar cost averaging to get into the S&P 500, or should
You're asking me very technical questions. So, you know, what I tell people, I actually literally said this to a client today. And again, it doesn't matter how big your denominator is. We have the same kind of conversation. Mathematically, you probably win every time by putting it all in at once. Psychologically, you win most of the time by going in slowly, whether it's every month, every week, whatever it is, in the dollar cost averaging strategy, because you just don't feel like you missed. Like, you're inevitably going to hit things and times that feel better. You're going to have some that feel worse, but psychologically, you're going to feel well. But again, mathematically, I can't cite the studies, but people will say it's, you know, it's the time in the market versus timing the market. And even though dollar cost averaging is this methodical way of, you're timing the market 100%. So I tell people that mathematically, it's probably better to just put it all in, as bad as it might feel at every time. But psychologically, it's probably better to do it the other way. And most people, again, I want your relationship to money to be healthy. I want your money to enable you, not distract you. So if dollar cost averaging makes you feel better about it, that's probably a good thing, because, you know, the folks at major firms like Vanguard used to cite, and probably still do, that investing in something like the S&P 500 or really the market, rather than trying to have active management, is a great way to invest. But if you do it on your own without someone helping you, you may sell at the wrong time because you get panicked. So I tell a lot of people that the best investment strategy is rarely the best strategy to invest their money, because most people can't stomach the ups and downs. People need access to their money at an inopportune time if they were in something that was volatile. So that's, I really try to impress upon people a few of those ideas. But again, going back to this, I think that most people probably will relate better to their money by dollar cost averaging. I think mathematically, if you fast forward 50 years and get in one of my time machines, you probably lost. But you probably won along the way because you felt better.
I asked ChatGPT, give me some ideas of how to dollar cost average my savings that I was going to invest in S&P 500. And ChatGPT recommended that I invest whatever, say, divide up in units. So say I'm invest one unit when you're up, when the S&P 500 is up, and two units when it's down. So I don't know if that makes a difference.
If Fielden sounds smart, I'm sure ChatGPT's done some math that I cannot do in my brain.
But
at one point knew 75 digits of pi, which is really just chunking a lot of phone numbers together. But man, I can't do the math that ChatGPT just did.
But you would, I mean, for simplicity's sake, you would say just put it all at once and time.
I would say that mathematically, that's going to work. But again, people have massive loss aversion versus gain elation. I think the ratio is like 5-1, meaning that you're so much more upset about losing money than you're excited about making money. And so I feel like people feel better about their investment if they're dollar cost averaging. It doesn't mean it was a better return. But remember, the return is not one dimensional. That's the financial return. There's the psychological return of your money, how you feel about it. And I think if you feel better about your money, you're going to live a more fulfilled lifestyle because it's not distracting you the same way. But again, I think that this is one of those things that there's the math, there's the psychology, there's everything in between.
If on the other side of the scale, so someone who just exited their company, they sold it for like say $5 million. Would you give them the same advice of putting money in S&P 500?
It depends on what they're looking to do. If someone's exiting, I always explain your money needs a personality. I need to understand what it's doing for you in your life. So let's say you were someone who had a big liquidity event like that. What do you want to do next? Most people are not small business owners. They're serial entrepreneurs. They just maybe haven't had the serial part happen yet. And so they're probably going to want to go do something else. And so they might say, wow, I want to be able to take no salary from my next endeavor. So they've got a couple of choices. They can compartmentalize and siphon off $250,000 of that $5 million and say, hey, I'm willing to spend this down in a year. I'm going to spend $250,000 this year. Or they might take $500,000 and say, I'm going to spend this down over the next 2 years. But I'm going to take the other $4.5 million and I'm going to invest it in a way that is somewhat permanent capital. Maybe it's something like the S&P 500. Maybe they become interested in angel investing and support other founders. Maybe they want to invest in some real estate, a lot of other things that have growth opportunity. You start giving up liquidity with some of those things. But then I have a lot of founders actually say, wait, Adam, you're saying that we can invest that $5 million in a way that pays me on time so that I can go and, because I'm the growth engine, Adam, not my money. And I believe that I'm the next leg to get my net worth from $5 million to $10 million or $20 million. So I say, okay, well, then why don't we just invest all of that $5 million in things that pay you on time to create a synthetic income that allows you to go after your next idea with no pressure. And right now, obviously, using the same comment I made before, you lend your $5 million to the government, they'll give you $250,000 a year or $20,000 a month, which is more than a lot of founders were paying themselves. And right now, there's other types of lending vehicles you can invest in that might pay you 10% or 12%. So you're in a time where at $5 million, you might easily be able to get 6 to 7% of yield right now. And suddenly you're making, $20,000, $25,000, $30,000 a month without getting out of bed. Now you're getting out of bed and you're starting a new business, but you're able to go in there in a very different mindset, say to the board, I'm not taking a salary for the first year or two. And it really empowers you to feel different than maybe in your first business. So I think it runs the gamut. It really depends on the mental framework that person has. But to me, it's always getting back to the proverbial why. Why are we doing these things? What are we solving for? And then we'll get to the what we're going to do. People always are very anxious. Say, what are you going to invest it in? I'm like, I have no idea. They're like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, the investing part's not that hard. It's figuring out what you need from your money to then invest it in a way that allows you to achieve your articulated goals with the least amount of stress. That's the job. So hopefully that's helpful.
What are your thoughts on Warren Buffett saying 95% of people should not invest out of the index funds. They should only invest, stick with the index funds.
I probably agree with that. Yeah, I think that the financial services industry tries to pretty up and sexy up a lot of investments to earn fees and commissions. It's a weird dynamic, because I think that index funds on average are going to be much cheaper. They're going to be much more tax efficient. The thing that I think people get confused about, those people will say things to me like, oh, an index fund is safe. And I'm like, an index fund is just a legal structure. What index? And they're like, oh, I'm like, if it's a bond index of treasury bills, that's really different than a triple levered index fund on the NASDAQ. And they're like, oh, I'm like, so I'm not worried about principal loss necessarily, but volatility will be radically different in an index fund, depending on what index it's tracking. And so I try to make sure people understand that when they say that to me. And I think it's pretty easy to explain, but I feel like it's much easier to just deploy into these very easily accessible, easily tradable, very liquid vehicles. I think the thing I'd add, though, is that investing in index funds could potentially, especially if they're equity or stock index funds like the S&P, like we talked about, they can move around a lot. And if you don't have someone coaching you and feeling good about it, then, you know, you go through, if you look at the S&P 500 between 2022 and 2023 together, the S&P was down a lot and then it was up a lot. And I think when you add it all together, it was maybe up a couple of percent with the dividends. If you look at the NASDAQ, I think it was down 33 and up 43. So between those 24 months, you were still down 3%. So I would say that the issue is that if you're investing heavily in stock index funds and you're not prepared for volatility, you might sell it at a bad time because you're nervous. And then imagine you sell here, it goes like this and back here, but you never got back in. So you crystallize the loss there. So all I say to people is, I think that for a lot of people, index funds are definitely the right thing. I think there's a lot of great digital advisors that exist now. I think you're starting to see the digital advisors, or robo-advisors as they were originally called. You're starting to see them have, you know, tens and tens of billions of dollars. I'm sure one of them will cross 100 billion soon. So they're really attracting assets. And I think there's levels of advice that exist there. So, but again, I think if you look at the vast majority of people, I think there's sexiness and excitement of investing in high-flying technology names or consumer product goods that you know and can use. But it's really hard to outpace the market. And so I tell most people, you know, I personally, again, not giving investment advice, any of my quote-unquote equity exposure is 100% passive in some type of a tracker to some index. I don't spend a lot of time there. It's just not somewhere that I think it's easy to repeatably show an edge. But you know, there's a lot of people out there that would disagree and, you know, are doing cool things, and that's great. But I think that most people, an index fund is a great mechanism to get access to stocks and bonds.
What are your thoughts on cryptocurrencies? Do you ever touch them?
Yeah. So again, I'll sort of toggle the line between personal and sort of fiduciary advisor, which is how I spend my day. You know, crypto is interesting. The way I try to explain it to people is it should have the payoff dynamics of what an angel investment could look like. But the difference is you have liquidity along the way. So I think there's definitely a place for people to have that kind of asymmetric payout, meaning something that can go up a lot. And it can go down a lot, but you know, you also can sell it. If you decide you're, you know, you don't want it to be down more than 50% than what you put in, but you think it might be up 1,000%. There aren't a lot of things you can invest in, and now in a much easier way through all the ETFs, that have that payoff dynamic. So if you, you know, there's a lot of smart people who think that crypto can, you know, the main crypto, which obviously most people think about is Bitcoin, people think it can go up, you know, still another, I don't know, 20 times from here, 50, who knows? I don't know if they're right or wrong, but there are a lot of smart people who think that that's right. And most people have nothing else they can invest in that has that chance. So if you put $10,000 in and you think, hey, man, if this goes well, it could be worth 100 grand. And if I decide I don't like it at 5,000, that's the limit I've decided to put in on the bottom. So I feel like that's the way I look at it. I think there's so many compelling arguments for blockchain. There's a lot of compelling arguments for supply demand and the halvings and things like that. Again, I am not an expert in this space. For what it's worth, any of my crypto exposure, I have, you know, handed to someone who spends their whole day doing this, because for me to have my own coins, which I did for a while, actually became quite distracting. I was looking at it and I was noticing it. And now I fortunately, you know, was able to weather a storm. But then once I sort of weathered the storm, I'm like, I don't need to do this myself. I like having some exposure, but I gave it to someone. But I think just owning some of the ETFs now, I think that it's got, I think it's interesting for people if they want that payoff dynamic. It should probably be a very, very small percentage. I always say invest some of this stuff where if it went down by a half and you could sell it, you wouldn't be that devastated. But also if it can go up 5 or 10x, you'd care. So if you did that with, you know, $100, you might say, if it goes down to 50, I lost 50, that stinks. But if it goes up to 1,000, it's not moving a needle. So maybe $100 isn't enough. And I think that's also important as people think about sizing. So definitely not for the faint of heart. One of the most volatile things that you can invest in.
Okay, makes sense. So one, I know we're out of time, but one last question I had was going back to that 300K example. So I took
The 300K example.
Well, we have to stay consistent, right? Because now
that's fine, no problem.
Suddenly change the example at the last question. So the 100K piece that I invested in S&P 500,
right?
It's been, say, like 30 years. Now it has grown to like a million.
Right.
Is there a formula or like, I know they're on the retirement communities and retirement side of things. There's like a, I think it's called drawdown or something that they take like a percentage. They sell a percentage.
Well, people talk about 4%, I think. It's not something that I'm as well focused on and versed on, to be candid. So I don't want to give misinformation, but I guess finish the question and I'll see.
Yeah. So what I wanted to ask you is like mathematically, is there a percentage, like assuming the goal is die with zero, is there a percentage, mathematically speaking, that I can use, say, starting at the age of 65,
the answer is I'm sure, I just don't know it off the top of my head. But it's not hard to model. These are, as I said, you know, any financial advisor can help model this. I would argue that a lot of the digital robo-advisors have these calculators. It's a pretty easy math equation to just sort of spend down a percentage over a certain amount of years with some expectation that as you're spending down, what's left in the corpus each year is also growing a little bit. So there's some counterbalance, but no, I don't know the numbers off the top of my head.
Okay. And what about the like target index funds that automatically like move from more volatile stocks to, or like index funds to like more of a bond type?
Well, it's, again, and I want to make sure I'm using the same nomenclature. So again, they may be all index funds. They just start moving from a more heavy stock index fund weighting to a heavier bond index weighting. But I'll give you an example. So my kids, you know, again, the 18-year-old, he's getting close to college, and I have what's called a 529 account, which some of you may know, which just the tax code is 529, but it's a college savings account where the, you know, the assets grow tax-free as long, and eventually you can withdraw them tax-free if you use them for appropriate, what they call deemed, you know, uses. The problem is in those target date funds, very similar, as the kids getting closer to college, it starts shifting to more bond funds or bond index funds, which makes sense because they should be less volatile. But if you look at interest rates, which, you know, bonds are priced based on interest rates. So it's just a big math equation. You know, interest rates have moved around a lot lately. So, you know, you could have been sitting in 80, 90% bond funds close to when you needed it, whether it was your retirement or whether it was for the college. And then all of a sudden, you know, your bond fund could have been down 11%. So I think that the only negative of the target date funds is that sometimes the asset classes don't always behave exactly as they have in the past. And if it has a somewhat regimented way, it's going to reallocate from one type of asset class into another in an environment where those asset classes don't behave like they have in the past. You can have an unintended consequence where there actually was more volatility or drawdown closer to when you needed it than you would have anticipated.
So personally, you would stay away?
No. I mean, I think that they've got a great place because most people probably wouldn't do a better job themselves. I'm just saying that I think that there could be unintended consequences and you're sort of locked into something that you may or may not, you know, feel as excited about. But I think for a lot of people, the less choice and interaction they can have, the less distracting it should be, the less emotion will creep in, which is what crushes people with investing. So I would say the less hands-on most people can be in terms of the day-to-day decisions, the better outcomes they're going to have. I have a funny statistic. At a major brokerage firm, there's two types of client accounts that are the best performers. What do you think the profile is of those two kind of clients?
Like,
they're patient. They don't touch the money.
Yeah, yeah. I'm trying to get a little more specific, but I'll jump to it. Dead, deceased people, and abandoned accounts. The least emotional customers that exist. And it tells you something, is that we can't help it. We're emotional creatures that act on impulse, not always rationale. And that feels like a good one to end at.
Yeah, well, I'm going to use that in my intro now. That was a fun one.
Well, a lot of great advice here. Thank you for spending so much time with us. And I'm sure a lot of people have a lot of additional questions, because I do. So if they want to reach out to you for some advice, how would they get in touch with you?
Yeah, I always say I'm sort of easy to find on the internet, and you know, I'm always here to help. So I always say, just, you know, Google my name and you'll probably find a way to reach out to me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, everyone.